So Genesis chapter 38, what happened in chapter 37 was Jacob has been spoiling Joseph. He's been favoring him. He's been putting him above all of his other sons. And that's caused a lot of bitterness in his family. So the brothers conspired together. They tackled Joseph. They stripped his cloak off. They threw him in a pit. They sold him into slavery. And they came back and they told their dad, like, oh man, we found his cloak on the ground and I think a wild animal got him. And the dad believed him. And Jacob had so idolized Joseph. The source of Jacob's life was in his son. Like, that was everything to him. Because Jacob is a guy, he's an idolater. He's like all of us. You know, and he's tried every means of idolization of things. And he's idolized his kid now. And he's turned his kid into his meaning for life. And because of that, he spoiled him rotten. He ruined his family dynamic. And now that he knows that Joseph is dead, it says at the end of the chapter that he refused to be comforted. The kids try to comfort him. He's like, no, you know, like, Joseph's dead. I don't want to live anymore. And he just became a shell of a man. And in chapter 38, Judah, who's one of the kids, he leaves. He leaves. He's done. He's like, dude, I'm sick of hanging out with my family. You know, my dad is a freaking drag. You know, he's just like moping about all the time. I don't like being around him. I don't like being with my brothers. So he leaves. He leaves the family and he goes into the area of Canaan. And so he starts to really slip into a lot of debauchery here. And you can know why, though, right? I mean, you guys understand why someone would do that. A lot of times when we grow up in a, if you grow up in a dysfunctional home, one of the easiest things you could do is just leave it, right? You just be like, man, I'm just going to leave this situation because it's just so jacked. You know, I don't want to deal with these people anymore. And sometimes that's a good thing. I would say for Judah, what he does in this chapter, that he left his family, wasn't a bad thing. In fact, I would probably say it was a good thing that he did. Where he went, though, wasn't a good thing, right? So he left his family situation. He's like, dude, this is jacked up. I'm gonna go where people aren't jacked up. And then he goes to the Canaanites, a group of people who are so messed up that they used to have gods that you would sacrifice kids to. And, you know, they would have incest and they would have orgies. And if you study some of the Canaanite gods, these were jacked up people, man. They were really messed up people. And Judah just goes, and he's like, man, I'm done hanging out with my messed up family. And he goes to an even more messed up family. And people do that all the time. You know, like I said, when I was in the Marines, I saw a lot of people were like that. You know, they're running away from their family situation by going into the military. And you go into the military, and the military is the most dysfunctional family you'll ever be a part of. You know, like I was there, it's like, it is so dysfunctional. I'm like, you left your family and you came here? Where we kill people, you know? Like, I mean, I get that your life before was a little messed up, but maybe this wasn't the place to go. And what it leads to when we do this is it leads broken people to become more broken. So sometimes it's good to leave a bad situation, but when you leave a bad situation, make sure you're going into a better one. The Bible is really clear, right? Bad company corrupts good, right? So the Bible is very clear, man. The people you hang out with, the people you associate with the most, they're going to impact you, whether you like it or not. So if you leave your family, that's cool, but be sure that you're leaving your family to hang out with people that are better than your family. And what's going to happen in Jacob and Joseph's life, and Judah's life, should I say, is they're both going to have to re-encounter their families eventually. And the work that God does in Judah and Joseph's life is actually pretty amazing. And he gets them to the place where they can minister to their family. Because another lie that we can tell ourselves, if you grow up in a dysfunctional situation, is that, like, dude, I need to reach out to my family. And, you know, the question that I have to ask you is, like, how much are you reaching out to your family, and how much is your family dragging you down? You know, maybe you do need to reach out to your family, but maybe it's just not now. You know, maybe give it a little bit. Give yourself a little space. Let yourself heal. Let yourself grow. Then go back and minister to your family. Give yourself some distance. But the reason why we don't do that, the reason why a lot of people don't do that, should I say, not everybody, but for me, what I see is usually a dysfunctional family situation that is like this is when you have a codependent parent, when you have a parent that's like Jacob, who, you know, uses his kids to get fulfillment. And he's just like, he's pouring out all of his junk on his kids. You know, he doesn't know how to set good boundaries with his children. You know, he's just like sitting down with them and he's just like pouring out all of his troubles on them, which is not what a parent's supposed to do, right? Parents not supposed to just dump their issues on their kids because their kids don't know what to do with them. And because of that, because you've grown up in like this dysfunctional, like kind of codependent life, you're like, man, I've actually talked to people and I was like, dude, why wouldn't you leave that situation? They'd be like, well, you know, I want to love my family. And it's like, where is it written down in the Bible that you can't love someone if you don't live in their house? You know, like, I don't live in my parents' house and I love them. You know, like, I mean, I moved out when I was 18 and my parents weren't like, you don't love us. You know, you're going to the military because you don't love us. I'm like, really? You know, they never said that to me. They're like, man, you know, go, you know, live your life. They were totally on board with it. Moving out doesn't mean you don't love your family. You know, you can move out and you could heal and you could reach out to your family as you need to. But Judah leaves and he goes to a much more jacked up situation. So in verse 1 it says this, it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. So notice he's hanging out with a guy. He's hanging out with a dude that's not the best example on him. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he married her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and he called his name Onan. She conceived yet again and bore a son, and called his name Shelah. And he was at Chezib when she bore him. Then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. And Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her, and raise up an heir to her to your brother. This was an ancient practice. God is actually going to so approve of this practice that in the law, it becomes a standard. I mean, when you go into Leviticus, this practice that Judah's talking about becomes the law for the nation of Israel. They had to fulfill it. And what the law was is that if I married Emma, you know, I didn't marry Emma, but if I married Emma and we were married for a while and I died without her having any kids, my brother would then be legally obligated to marry her and then to have a kid, and the first kid that he would have with her that was male, he would name him Peter. And it was a picture of like continuing this guy's line, you know, because he never had a kid, so I'm going to continue his line. I'm going to take care of my brother's name, and that way everyone can know about my brother and his legacy. It was an idea of, like I said, you know, preserving the legacy of your family. It was a way of taking care of your family. Now, obviously, nowadays we don't practice that anymore, right? Can you guys think of why? Because it's weird. No, that's biblically the answer. Jesus said, don't do that anymore because it's weird. You know, he didn't say it. Can you guys think of why he would say that for Israel, but why we don't do that anymore? It's a family line, right? So back in Israel, God was wanting to preserve the family line, to raise it up, to make it like family and community. And everything was really, really important for the people of Israel because they're trying to build a genealogy before God. And it was really cool. That was his plan. That was his purpose. The church isn't like that, right? The church grows not by family, but the church grows by conversion. Does that make sense? That's how the body of Christ has grown. It's not through family. It's through conversion. Israel wasn't that way. Israel, you couldn't really be an atheist, you know what I mean? Like, you couldn't grow up in Israel and be like, oh, I don't think I believe in God. Well, if you did that, you're in Israel, and that means you're under the covenant of God. So you can't live your life as if there's no God. If you did that, you'd be killed. You would have to leave Israel if you wanted to not be under the covenant of God. We as Christians aren't like that, right? We don't want to do that. We don't want to, well, some Christians do, but we shouldn't. Right, we shouldn't be. Our way of changing the world is not through the government. Right, we're not like, man, let's change all the laws to be Christian. You know, let's punish people for not being Christian. We don't do that, right? I mean, just think about it. Would you guys like it if you were living in a country that was Islamic and said like you have to live this way or else we're going to punish you? No, right? We would hate that. So the question is, why would you want to do that to other people? Right? Why would you want to set up a Christian government and make people live Christian lives, even though they're not Christians? When you look at the Founding Fathers, the cool thing about our Founding Fathers is that they created a system of government where there is, don't get me wrong, there is morality that is governed. But at the end of the day, I mean, the laws that we have in America are pretty loose, aren't they? I mean, when it comes to morality, it's not like, dude, if you have sex before marriage, you know, you go to jail. You know, if you have, if you commit adultery, jail. You know, you know, it's not like that. There's laws that protect us, but at the end of the day, they never enforce morality because they realize that Christianity is grown through conversion and through the love of Christ, and you're not supposed to impose Christian morals on the world. You're not supposed to do that, right? So I shouldn't go talk to my friends who are in the Marine Corps, and he's, you know, like having sex, he's living with his girlfriend. I shouldn't go to him and be like, dude, you shouldn't do that. Why not? Because the Bible says no. Well, he's like, well, I don't believe in the Bible. Well, still, you know, going to hell, bro. You know, I mean, the first step is that dude, if he doesn't accept Christ as the Lord, you know, why would he do what the Bible tells him to do? Does that make sense? It's only through his conversion that he would then start listening to that. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 5, Paul says, what do I have to do with judging the world? Man, I don't have anything to do with judging the world. I could judge the church. I could look at people who claim Christ and say this is the standard that we should be living towards, but I can't judge people who don't accept the Bible. It doesn't work that way. So that's one of the reasons why we don't have those kind of laws in the New Covenant anymore. We don't follow these kind of laws anymore. Because it's not about preserving a nation. It's not about preserving a governmental system or a family. It's more about our individual relationships with the Lord. But anyway, this is what he's telling him to do. He tells his son, like, go marry your brother's widow, you know, raise up a kid in his name and his honor, and in that way you'd be honoring him. Verse 9, but Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing that he did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. And he said, lest he also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelled in her father's house. Now, this is really interesting because this is what Catholics will use. This is the verse that Catholics will use to say that contraception, any type of birth control, is wrong. And they'll say, see, God killed somebody for practicing birth control, right? And what's happening here is not rocket science. Right? Back in the day, they didn't have condoms. So it's like, how do you prevent births? You just don't what? You emit on the ground. You just don't allow your seed to go into the woman. And that way she won't conceive. Right? Not rocket science. It's not mind-blowing. That's what they did back in the day. And the reason why God is punishing him is actually said right in the next verse. What does it say? Verse 10. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. I'm sorry, it's in verse 9. Lest he should give an heir to his brother. So what's the wickedness before God? Is it the fact that he practiced birth control? Is that the wickedness? All right, what's the wickedness? Lest he should give his brother an heir, right? Selfishness. He didn't want to preserve the name of his brother. So the wickedness that God is punishing is not the birth control, it's not the contraception, it is the idea of honoring your brother. That was the idea. So when he was going into Tamar, why was he doing it? He's like, man, I think she's pretty, you know? This is awesome. I get to have sex with her. But it wasn't about preserving his family name, it wasn't about preserving the lineage, and so God strikes him dead. He kills him. That's important for us to know. Because inside of our marriages, you know, it's okay to practice birth control, right? There's nothing in the Bible that says that's wrong. There's nothing in the Bible that says that would be incorrect for us to do. Now, there is particular birth control methods that we should look at and say, probably not. You know, what can you guys think of? Which ones, for a Christian, should we probably not do? Morning after pill, what's that? That's right, and it kills the fetus. So it would be if there's a fertilized embryo in there, you take this pill and it's actually a type of poison and it actually kills that embryo and then it flushes out of your system. So we as Christians, we probably shouldn't do that. Why? Because it's abortion. It's an abortive agent. And there's actually a lot of types of birth controls that are abortive agents. And that's why we as Christians, we should be smart. We should be looking into things. There are some types of birth control pills and stuff that the way that they function, the way that they work, is that they just kill anything that may attach to your uterus. So as a woman, as a man, you should be thinking about that. Of like, okay, well, there's stuff that I could do to prevent pregnancy for sure that doesn't displease God. However, there's some stuff that does. And I need to be savvy. I need to be thinking about these things, lest I, you know, do something that's not right. That's not correct before God. Now, if we're thinking about this way, that's something that we can pull from this passage for sure. But what's the major moral lesson here? What's the major moral lesson that we should take from this? It has nothing to do with contraception, does it? That's the big one, right? To obey God. Here's one that I'll lay out for you guys. It says in Hebrews chapter 13, it says, keep the marital bed pure and undefiled. And that passage blows a lot of people away. Because what it's saying is that even though you're married, you can still defile the bed. Does that make sense? That means that our ideas of sexual morality may be a little bit too simplistic. Because is Onan married to Tamar? Yeah. He's having sex with his wife. That should be totally okay, right? But there's a heart behind why he's having sex with his wife that makes God displeased. And me as a married man, I should be thinking that in my relationship with my wife. There's a way that I could have sex with my wife that would displease God. Now, what things maybe can be in my heart when I'm having intimacy with my wife that would displease God? What do you guys think? Lustful thoughts? Right? So maybe I'm having intimacy with my wife, but maybe we're watching porn together, right? Which a lot of couples do. Now, do you guys think that would be wrong? Why? But you're married, right? I mean, what's wrong with watching porn together? Yeah, right? So I'm using other people, right? So God created marriage and the marital bed to be something holy, set apart, something between me and my wife. You know, I tell people this all the time. Is it pornography for me and my wife to have intimacy tonight? No. What makes it porn? When we videotape it, right? And then we upload it onto the internet. Now it's porn. Because it's not about our hearts. It's not about the context of our marriage. Because people who are watching it, people who are watching me and my wife, they're watching something holy and intimate and special. That's supposed to be between me and her. And now we've taken something special and we've uploaded it for other people's pleasure. So they could use us in order to gratify themselves. And they don't realize, the people who are watching it, they don't realize the context of our marriage. They don't realize the love that we have for one another. They don't realize the years of marriage that have gone into that. They've completely taken the context out of relationship. And they've just used it as just like, oh, it's about sex. Right? And that's one of the greatest crimes of pornography in my mind, is that pornography takes context out of sexual relationship. So that me growing up watching pornography, right, watching people have sex, you know, I wasn't watching, you know, if you guys have ever watched porn, you know that, you know, when you go onto a porn website, it's not like everything's crazy and out of the box. There's like, you could watch some porn that's just like a man and woman having sex, right? But you could also watch some stuff that's way out of the box, right? You could watch bestiality. You could watch orgies. You could watch barely legal stuff. You could watch a lot of different types of things on porn websites. But you could watch some stuff that's not crazy. And the reason why it's wrong is because when I'm watching the stuff that's not too crazy, what it's teaching me is it's teaching me that sex has no context. Right? I could just meet a girl at the bar. We don't need to learn each other's names. We could just have sex. It's not a big deal. Or even when I'm having intimacy with my wife. You know, our intimacy is something separate from the marriage. And that's what a lot of people think when they're married. They're like, no, our intimacy is just a separate issue. It's a separate issue from the marriage. Instead of something that naturally has a context, right? That's something that's coming out of the marriage. Something like me and my wife love each other. We care about each other. And we want to protect each other. And we want to enjoy one another. And that naturally overflows into our sex lives. Does that make sense? If I don't do that, then the context that I'm bringing to my sexuality with my wife could be wrong. And it could just be like, you know, in the one of the hadith in Islam, it says, if you as a husband, like Muhammad, he was walking through one day and he saw a girl that he was attracted to. And he's like, man, that girl is awesome. And he went home and had sex with one of his wives. And he said, man, if you're aroused, he said, just go to one of your wives. That's what they're there for. Right. And that was his mind. Now we would look at that and be like, okay, is he married to this girl? Yeah. But is it wrong? Is what he did wrong? Why? Why is he going to his wife? Is it because he loves her? And he's like, honey, I just love you, you know, and I just want to experience, you know, intimacy with you, because this is what we're doing the rest of our marriage. Just mutual caring, mutual love, mutual dedication. And let's let this overflow into our marital bed. Is that what's going on? No. What aroused him? What made him want to have sex? Another woman. Does that make sense? So now his wife has just become a substitute for adultery. You guys get that? He's like, well, I don't want to commit adultery because that's wrong. But I'll let this girl rouse me and then I'll go into my wife. Which is what porn would do too. If me and my wife are watching pornography together, is my wife arousing me? Is my wife the reason why I want to have sex? No, it's these other people who I don't even know. And how long before, you know, if I'm like, hey, honey, let's watch porn together every single night. How long before she's like, do you even like me? Are you even attracted to me? You know, do you even love me in any way? Or is it just these people that makes you like interested in sex? You guys get that? It'll start to kind of mess with your head a little bit. So there's a context that I could bring into sexuality, even with my wife, that's not correct. And that's why, like I said, the Catholic Church likes to take that one message out of it because we don't want to think that way. In the Christian, we're like, that's hard. That's hard. You know, that it's not just about waiting till marriage. There's a context that I have to bring into sexuality with my wife, and I have to fight the urges and the cravings in my life. That's what you're telling me? That sounds really difficult. Well, yeah, it's difficult, but following God isn't easy. Jesus said what? Take up your cross daily and follow me. That's what he said. He didn't say, hey, man, it's going to be easy, dude. Dude, put down your cross and follow me, man. Stop torturing yourself, dude. It's going to be easy to follow me. He's like, dude, now you're gonna die daily. It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. Man, it hurts daily when I'm seeking correct intimacy with my wife, and I do fail at this. I do fail at this. I do sometimes bring wrong context into my intimacy with my wife, and I need to be thinking about this and saying, like, man, is there a way to love that doesn't glorify God? Does my wife see the selfless, sacrificial love of God in the way I treat her in the bed and out of the bed? Or is she getting a context of selfishness from me? And that's one of the major reasons of why, you know, sexuality becomes such a sticking point for most marriages. It pulls them apart. Because if I'm selfish out of the bed, I'm going to be selfish in the bed. You guys get that? Right, when you think about, you know, God and his love for us, it's always about the betterment of his beloved, right? It's always about that. It's not about him. It's not about what he can get out of it. Right, God doesn't save me and he doesn't look at me and say, hey, what can I get out of you, bro? Right, he saved me for my sake. You know, and if I want to love my wife that way, which the Bible, by the way, tells me I need to, right? Husbands, love your wives just as Christ what? Love the church, right? So the Bible's not like, hey, husbands, love your wife any old way. You know, any way that feels good to you, love them that way. It's like, no, you need to love them the way that Christ loved me. And how did Christ love me? Sacrificially. Always puts me first. Always puts my needs first. Now, here's another thing. This is going to just to slip in there, you know, just to kind of get you guys thinking. The reason why Jesus is able to love me perfectly is because he understands me perfectly. You guys get that? Jesus never has to look at me and be like, hey, Peter, what do you want? Why does he never have to do that? Because he already knows what I want. Does that make sense? He never has to say it because he already knows. But do I know what my wife wants? Do I perfectly understand her? No, I don't. So if I want to know what my wife actually wants, I have to do what? I have to ask, right? I have to ask, hey, honey, do you like this? Hey, honey, is this good for you? Honey, what do you appreciate? Right? I have to ask. Through understanding comes love. And like I said, it applies to everything across the board and everything in our marriage. Do I know what my wife likes and appreciates about the way I clean the house? Or am I just like, well, I've always done it this way, so I'm going to keep doing it this way. And if you don't like it, you leave. You know, like you're like, I don't care. You know, I clean the house this way, woman, you know, and you submit to my cleaning, you know. Or do I look at her and be like, hey, am I cleaning the house for me or am I cleaning the house for who? My wife. So maybe I should what? Ask her, right? Do you appreciate when I do this? There was a time where Emma like blew my mind, right? I was cleaning the house one day and she was all bummed out. I was like, why are you bummed out? And she's like, all you're doing is cleaning and you're not spending any time with me. And it like blew my mind. I was like, what? Like I'm cleaning the house. For you, you know, like and you're going to be upset about that. And who was I really cleaning the house for? For me, right? I never even thought, what does my wife want me to do? You guys get that? Because I never asked. I assumed I knew. And that's why so many husbands after 20 years of marriage are like, I don't get women, you know? Well, have you asked? Have you made any effort to get your wife? Or do you just assume that you should know? And then when she gets mad about something that you do, do you just get all hurt about it? And you like, oh, you know, she didn't like it when I did that, so I'm not going to try anymore. Or are you going to be like, hi, honey, like, what do you appreciate? I always think about Michael from The Office. Like, he's my ultimate example of what not to do, right? Michael from The Office, he, you know, at one point, you know, he buys the entire office lunch. And you know what he buys him? He buys him his favorite sandwich. So he buys a ton of his favorite sandwich, which was just ketchup, like bologna and mayonnaise or something like that. It's like disgusting sub sandwich. And everybody in the office is like, dude, I hate this. And no one takes it. And he's like, ugh. And he like gets all frustrated and he leaves. Now, at that point, what do you realize? Why did he buy the sandwiches? Who is it for? For him. It was so people could look at him and be like, thank you, Michael. Thank you so much for buying us lunch. Now, what would have been the loving thing? If he would have asked, what do you guys want for lunch? Then he bought that for them. That would have been loving. But instead, he assumed. And when people reject it, he's just like, well, I tried. I tried to be loving, you know, and people just didn't appreciate me. So I'm done. Well, did you ask, right? That's the easy. You have not because you ask not, man. Like, you need to ask, right? Be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to wrath, right? That's what the Bible tells me to do. So there's a context I could bring to sexuality, even with my wife, that is wrong. Now, here's the other lesson that we learned from this, okay? So afterwards, he's supposed to marry her to his youngest, right? That's the next step. He's supposed to marry her to the youngest. He doesn't. Now, he kind of insinuates a little bit. He says, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he also die like his brothers. So whose fault is it? In Judah's mind, whose fault is it that his sons died? Who is it? Tamar. Can't be my boys. My boys are awesome, dude. They're my boys. It's got to be this woman coming into their lives. This Canaanite woman, this evil woman. Man, she's the cause. She's the problem. Right? Now, the reason why he's like this is because, you know what? This is the truth. Every one of us, no matter how good or bad your upbringing was, you have tendencies that you've learned from your family. You just have. We all got junk. We all got garbage from our upbringing. And if you want to do better, you got to realize it's there. The people who don't realize it's there, they're the people that are most controlled by it. The people that realize it's there, they're the people that do the best with it. That's why it's almost, in a lot of times in the church culture, it's best when people grow up with dysfunctional upbringings. Because people who grow up with dysfunctional upbringings are like, I know I'm a wreck because of my family. Because my family's a wreck. But Christians who grow up in relatively good houses, they're like, well, I should be fine. My family was fine. No, you're not. You got garbage. You got junk in you. Because unless you were raised by Jesus himself, you got junk. You were raised by imperfect parents. Doesn't make it their fault, right? Your parents do the best they know how to do. But at the end of the day, if you don't recognize that there's something in you that's been brought up by your family, you're never going to be able to deal with it. Now, Judah was brought up in a dysfunctional home, right? He was brought up in a home where his dad always favored one of the kids. And so Judah, he grows up and he says, I would never be like my dad. I would never be like my dad. I'm going to do everything for my kids. I'm going to treat them all the same. I would never favor any of them. And so because of that, he is unwilling to see when his kids are evil. Does that make sense? How wicked did these kids have to be that God's striking them dead? Right? I mean, look at the people that we're reading about. Judah sold his own brother for money into slavery, and God didn't even strike him dead. So it's like, just think about that. How wicked must his kids be that God's like, dude, you're done. You know, I'm wiping you out. Like, obviously God's tolerance for wickedness is pretty high, you know? So when I read this story, I'm like, dude, these kids, it doesn't mention what they're doing, but they must be radically evil after reading the first chapters of Genesis, right? Simeon and Levi had people circumcise themselves and killed an entire city of people while they were recovering from their surgery, right? You know, in quotations, right? They did that. And God didn't strike them dead. It's like, dude, how wicked are these guys? It blows my mind. And Judah can't see it. Because he grew up in a family. What? He's grown up in a family where his dad favored a son. And he grew up saying, I would never do that. And so because of that, he's loving his kids so much, and I put that in quotations, he's loving them so much, he refuses to see what's wrong with them. You guys get that? Anything happens to his kids, must be someone else's fault, right? My kid got detention, the teacher must have screwed up, right? You know, my daughter's pregnant at 13, well, that's because she's running with a bad crowd. It's the public school system. That's why, you know, and man, you know, like something happens at summer camp, oh, those ministers, they did something wrong because there's no way it could be my daughter. No way that she messed up, you know, it's everybody else, it's not my kid. Because if they think it's their kid, who do they have to think about? Themselves. Maybe I'm not a perfect parent. And they don't want to think that. Judah doesn't want to think that. He's like, no way, I'm a good parent. I'm not favoring my kids the way that my old man did. I'm a good dad. But is he really? Probably not. Probably not. And we're going to see a father of the year moment right here. Right? So he's supposed to marry this girl off to his son. I'm not going to read it to you guys. Because we're running out of time. As well said. So he's kind of bummed out that his kids are dead. So he's hanging out with his buddy. He's being comforted. And he's walking down the road. And Tamar sees him walking down the road. And she sees that his youngest son is a man now. He's grown up. And she's like, dude, I'm not married to him. What's up? So she dresses like a prostitute. She goes on the side of the road. Judah sees her. And he, you know, purchases her. And he says, what do you want for your services? She says, give me a goat. He says, I don't got one on me. You know, I left my wallet back at the house. What can I give you for some collateral? She's like, hey, give me your MasterCard. You know, it was like his cane and his like signet ring, which is like what they used to purchase things back in the day. And that was unique to him. She's like, give me those. And he's like, right on. They have sex. She conceives. Now, here's the thing. How did Tamar know that he would buy a prostitute? He must have had a pattern, right? You know, this plan is stupid unless he regularly did this. So is Judah a good guy? No, he's not a good guy. And she knows. He's got a reputation of being a scumbag. So she dresses up like a prostitute and she lets him do this to her. And afterwards, she starts getting pregnant. She starts getting the belly. And people see it and they're like, dude, your daughter-in-law is a whore, right? She whored herself out. She's pregnant. What do you want to do? He's like, dude, burn her. So, I mean, like, is it okay for Judah to say, like, maybe, you know, she's committed adultery. Maybe it's okay for like, a stoning or something like that. Maybe. That's kind of crossing the line, but maybe. But burning? Executing someone by burning them? That's not just killing them. That's torturing them to death, right? And that's what he said should happen. And you see that he's like, I knew it. I knew that girl was no trouble. I knew she was nothing but trouble, man. She killed my sons. Now I get to burn her. And he's all happy. He's like, yeah. And she's like, hey, you know, you can if you want. But the guy who got me pregnant, these are his. Do you know who they are? And she gives him the staff and the ring. And he's like, oh, that's mine. And he, yeah. Yeah, he like totally gets his comeuppance, right? Like he's just thrown in his face. And he goes, you know what? She was more righteous than me. And so he's not saying, is he saying that she's okay, that she did right? No, right? Dressing up like a prostitute and having sex with your dad-in-law, not a great, you know, thing to do, right? But he's not a good plan, right? The Bible's not saying that's okay, right? He says that she's more righteous than me, though. He's saying what she did is jacked up, but what I did was way more jacked up, right? I blamed her when it was really my fault. I needed to look at myself as a father. And God used this situation. God used this situation to change Judah's life. Because from here on out, he starts really thinking through the mistakes he's made and why his life really is the way that it is. And he starts changing. And that's something that's really cool. That's what needs to happen in all of our lives. Once we stop blaming and start owning the things we've done before God and receiving his true forgiveness for us, then we could start changing. And Judah does it. But it took this circumstance for him to wake up. Right? It took this for him to be like, oh, crap. You know, I was wrong. I need a change. And it says that he took care of her. And it says that he didn't even marry. He didn't have sex with her ever again, which he could have. Right. He could have married her. She's young. She's beautiful. I'm going to marry her. But that would have been wrong. So he just takes care of the kid. He owns what he did. And he accepts the consequences. He's like, no, I did this. That's my kid. I'm going to take care of it. And that's really cool. You see Judah changing. You see God changing his life. So a lot of times when you're looking out at your family, your friends, and you're like, dude, they're screwing up, they're messing up, I can't believe what's going on in their life, God is judging them. Do you guys understand that? God is judging them. He's judging them through their consequences. And they have a choice. Every single time their life starts, you know, Judah had a choice. After each son died, he had a choice to be like, maybe there's something wrong with me. Maybe there's something wrong with me. But he denied it, and finally he's accepting it. And so sometimes, you know, if you've said your piece to somebody, if you told them, like, dude, what you're doing is wrong, and they just ignore you, what it says in Titus 3, verse 10, it says, deny a divisive man after the first and second admonition, knowing that such a person is self-condemned, being warped in his own mind and sin. So what Titus is saying is, dude, if I've said my piece to someone twice and they're like, I don't care, saying it three times is probably not going to help the situation. What you need to wait is you need to wait for the natural consequences of what they're doing to come out of their life, and then you can talk to them, right? And hopefully they'll learn like Judah did. Now, the crazy thing is that this two kids come out. One is named Perez. The other is named Zerah. I don't have time to get into the birth story, but it's kind of funny. But anyway, Perez comes out, Zerah comes out. Perez and Tamar are both mentioned in the genealogy of Christ. Isn't that crazy? So Matthew and Luke, they both mention this story. They're like, dude, this is how Jesus came to be. And they mention this jacked up ancestry. And it's Jesus saying to the world, he's saying to the world, I am the God of the sinners. Right? I'm the God of the broken. I'm the God of the people that are messed up. Right? That's who he came for. Jesus says, I didn't come for the well. You don't come for people who are... The doctor doesn't make house calls for people who are healthy. That doesn't make any sense. He says, I came for the sick. Right? Why is Perez, why is Tamar, why is Judah mentioned in the genealogy of Christ? Because they're what? Sick. And that's who Jesus came for. So when we look at the family of Christ, we see a lot of rotten stuff, but we also see the gospel shining through always. Well, anyway, let's pray. And we went a little over, but that's okay. You God, I want to thank you that you give us this story. You help us understand that all of us, every single one of us is a mess. Lord, we all have lust in our hearts. We all have things that's wrong with us, Lord. And we praise you that you are the God of the broken. We thank you for this story, that it shows us that you reach out to people who are just such a mess of individuals, God. And you take these people who are broken, you take Judah, who is so selfish and so wicked, and you turn him into a man who's honorable, a man who served you for the rest of his life, God, and who is even named in your genealogy. And we thank you for that. Please do that in our lives and help us to be faithful to confess sin to you, Lord, to know that when we're wrong and not to blame. And in your name, amen.